Hi, I'm Jen Myers, and my favorite thing is Mystery Science Theater 3000.
Welcome to the Finding Favorites podcast, where we explore your favorite things without using an algorithm. Here's your host, Leah Jones.
Hello, and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones. Like the introduction says, this is the podcast where we talk to people about their favorite things and get recommendations without using an algorithm. And one of these days, I'm going to figure out that maybe three times is too many times to say that in a podcast. But until I figure that out, please subscribe, rate, and review the podcast on iTunes or wherever you're getting your podcasts. Spidey says hello. He's on top of the microphone right now. Spidey is my 19-year-old cat who's just got to be where the action is all the time. This week on the podcast, I am talking with Jen Myers. Jen is a Chicago-based technologist and writer who answered the call on Twitter when I said that I was having trouble booking women, which is something that Jackie Cation has said about the Dork Forest. And I poo-pooed her and didn't think it would be so hard. But the truth is, men are way more likely to accept an interview and follow up and schedule. So I am looking for women and non-binary folks who want to talk about their favorite things on this podcast. So please reach out. So but Jen saw the tweet and she said she would be happy to talk about her favorite thing. And her favorite thing is Mystery Science Theater 3000. It has had so many iterations. So my guess is you've caught some version of Mystery Science Theater 3000, whether it was the original ones that came out in the 90s or the reboot or the movie or the tour. A lot of fun ways to engage in this property. Jen and I, we start the interview thinking we just don't have anyone in common. And by the end, you will realize along with us that her podcast host, co-host, she has a podcast called Quiet Little Horrors, which is a monthly podcast that discusses psychological horror films. Her co-host is a dear friend of mine, and it really took us over an hour to realize we had anyone in common and have probably met in person before. But that's kind of Chicago and Twitter, as you'll hear from week to week. So this weekend was a hard and weird week. It was the Republican National Convention, just a full authoritarian display from the Republican Party or what's left of it. And I have said in private with friends and publicly in meetings at my synagogue that I try really hard not to slip totally into cynicism and nihilism and fatalism. And this podcast and these conversations sometimes feel very silly. Like, why am I talking to someone about Mystery Science Theater 3000 when there's a war going on out there? Right. Which is what if you listen to the Great Comet episode or listen to the cast recording of the Great Comet, is that there's a war going on out there. And isn't it silly to talk about things that bring us joy? But there's also this really great labor song called Bread and Roses, that people need bread and roses too. People have to eat, they have to have health care, they have to have shelter, but we need roses. We need beautiful things, things that bring us joy, silly moments. And so I'm going to keep doing this podcast, even in the weeks where it feels like the easiest thing to do would be to stop talking about the things we love. But the things we love are going to be what helps keep us moving forward, I think. And I don't think this podcast is so important. I'm just maybe just justifying why I want to keep having conversations with people about the things they love, because I am really enjoying the opportunity to have these deep conversations with people. I hope that you are able to stay safe. Keep wearing your mask, wash your hands. If it's back to school for you and your family, every decision this fall is a hard one. So I hope that you are finding ways to take care of yourself and take care of your family. And so without further ado, please enjoy this interview with Jen Myers about Mystery Science Theater 3000.
and welcome to Finding Favorites. I'm your host, Leah Jones, and this is the podcast where we get recommendations from people without an algorithm. I'm very excited today. I am joined by Jen Myers. Jen is a writer, a technologist, podcaster, and we have a fair number of mutuals on Twitter, but we were introduced to each other when I realized I had too many interviews with white men lined up. And if I release too many episodes of men in a row, my sister will quit listening. So I put out the call on Twitter and I said, surely there's some women out there who want to talk about their favorite things. And lo and behold, here I am today talking with Jen. How are you doing today, Jen?
I'm good, thanks. I will take any opportunity to talk about things that I like. So I jumped on that.
I love it. So before we get into talking about your favorite thing, I would love to learn a little bit more about you. I looked at your website and really felt shocked that I didn't already know you, because we're both in Chicago and have both been on Twitter since 2007. So it's just our social circles must like just skate off of each other.
Yeah, it is strange. I feel like every once in a while I still come across people like that. I'm like, why do I not already know you? But I guess it's kind of a positive thing that there's always new people to go discover out in the world that you're aligned with. So I guess you can look at it that way.
Yeah. So what has been keeping you busy during the great pause?
Well, I mean, honestly, I've been looking for a new job. So, but I did recently at least land some work for the time being. So that's good. I currently work mostly in technical writing, curriculum writing, that sort of thing. I have a background as the web developer, and then I moved into doing more tech education stuff, and I'm focusing on tech writing right now. So, yeah. And then, you know, my own projects, like you mentioned, I have my own podcast. I do my own writing on the side and things like that. And I also have a teenager. So kind of a mix of all of those things.
Yeah. So I read one of the I was reading a post that you wrote in January about the ways that you were getting your own use of social media under control, or controlling your use of it in a different way. I don't want to say it was out of control before. Have you been able to stay weaned off of social media during COVID, or has how you used it changed since January?
I think I've been doing a pretty good job. As you mentioned, I've been on Twitter for a long time. So I think that I've learned over the years how it works for me and how it doesn't work for me. Because it's different for every individual, right? So, you know, whenever I talk about that, like, this works for me, it may not work for you. I think that I had enough practice so that when we're in these, you know, these times that are more extreme, I'm grateful I've had that practice, because I think if I hadn't, it would be a lot more challenging to, like, know the signs of when it's too much. I'm really good at that now. And, you know, I think somebody's coined doom scrolling and things like that. But I feel like I already developed some pretty good, sensors for when it's starting to tip the scales into this is bad for me. And I know to, like, step back. So I think I'm doing a pretty good job. I also, a couple of things that I do to help regulate it is that I don't really use my phone that much. I do all my stuff pretty much like on my laptop, which I actually don't use my phone much at all unless I have to. I don't know if I'm just elderly or what, like I don't text a lot, but my only texting is me and my daughter sending each other memes basically. And so I don't really do a lot on my phone unless I'm out somewhere. So that helps too, that like when I shut my laptop down, like I'm done. Like I usually don't have my phone with me, that sort of thing. So I think that's helped a lot. I think it's also helped that I'm old, so I go to bed really early. And so I at a certain point of the day, I just shut all the internet stuff down, basically, pretty much. So I think those two things have helped me a lot.
I live alone with two cats, so I doom scroll all day. But the phone I have now has you can set a bedtime on it. So yeah. I've set a bedtime of 11, or maybe the phone suggested 11. I don't even remember making the choice, but at 10:45, I have set all of my devices to go to like an evening mode. So the apps go dark. And at 10:45, I get this alert from my phone that's like, your bedtime's coming up. And I'm like, you know what? My bedtime is coming up. So I have found My sleep is the most regulated it's ever been as an adult, now that we're just home all the time.
Yeah, I think that that's also a good thing. I'm a big fan of sleep. I don't know. I feel like I've been a single mother for about 15 years, and I think I had to learn through necessity of like some of these ways of like regulating myself, because mm-hmm. I had to. But I think that they've done me a lot of good. You know, my daughter's a teenager, so she doesn't need me to do as much as I used to. So, you know, I could like, you know, be more flexible in those things, but going to bed early, getting my sleep, you know, kind of limiting the internet use, that actually just makes me feel better, even if I don't have to do it anymore. So, yeah, I know it's easier said than done. I'm not perfect all the time. You know, we all have those things, but I think that once you start like, you know, regulating a little bit better, you see you feel better, and then that helps you continue it. So yeah, not so bad. Hopefully that continues, as because it sounds like we might be kind of dealing with this situation for a while. So
yeah, I think I last weekend I had a rental car, and so I went to Target and I went to TJ Maxx for the first time in months, and I bought some new sheets, and I was buying some stuff, and I was like, what am I doing? And I was like, oh, I'm nesting, because I think I'm going to want to be comfortable this fall.
Yeah, I think that's a good idea. You know, especially little things like that, you're taking care of yourself, you're taking care of your home. So it's not a bad thing, but I agree with you. It's like kind of the underlying, well, we're going to be doing this. So I think I've been having a little bit of the opposite, where I've been like walking like crazy, just like miles and miles, because I'm kind of like, I need to get as much fresh air and sunshine and like store it up in me.
Yeah, I did just get a letter from my rheumatologist where he was essentially like, you have to go outside. You have either take some vitamin D or just go outside.
Yeah, that I do enjoy walking. So, and I think it's relatively safe, you know, if you're masked up and you can stay away from people, I think it's a good thing. So that's kind of what I've been doing. It's just, I just walk all over the place. I started playing Pokemon Go again. So it helps me, you know, and I actually got my daughter to go out on some walks with me. That was the only way I could lure her out, was with Pokemon Go. And she's already doesn't do quite as much, but I've kept it up. So that's like my other, you know, impetus to go out and take walks, is to go catch Pokemon. So, you know, whatever works.
So do you always start from home, or do you sometimes like take a bus somewhere and then walk in a new neighborhood?
I always start from home. I'm really lucky. I live real close to the lake. And like you said, we're here in Chicago, so Lake Michigan, for anyone who's wondering. And I love the lake, and you know, it was kind of tough. I understood why the trail was closed down earlier in the year, but it was tough. But now that it's open, and again, I mentioned like I'm an early bed person, so I get up early too. So it's nice and quiet. So I usually go down by the Lakeshore Trail.
Oh, that's great. So, Jen, what are we here to talk about today?
Well, since you gave me free license, I wanted to talk about Mystery Science Theater 3000.
I'm so excited. I'm so excited. I watched it a lot in high school. So I graduated high school in 95. So it was a comedy. It was on. We watched it all the time, but I kind of fell out with I was looking at IMDb, and there have been so many reboots that I have just kind of have missed the boat on. So I'm excited to hear from you what you love about it, what parts of it you still watch. And so let's for people who aren't familiar with MST 3000, how would you describe it just as a brief synopsis?
Yeah, it is a little bit strange. I mean, I guess you could call it, a lot of people talk about it as it's, you know, making fun of movies, bad movies, usually old, bad kind of like monster movies, sci-fi movies, things of that nature. And it's set in the context of like a bad science experiment. Well, I guess they think it's very good, the person who's doing it. But anyway, they're subjects of a science experiment to watch bad movies, and they're forced to watch bad movies. And so the only way to survive watching the bad movies is to make jokes about it. And that's kind of how it is. So, you know, the show was set up with, it's mostly you watch the movie, and even if people don't know it, they probably know it. That's where the little silhouettes at the bottom of the screen are, the people sitting in a movie theater making jokes about a movie. And then there was like segments of like skits and things of that nature that talk more about like the story of the scientist and his victims.
Yeah. So how did you find it for the first time? What's your origin story of being a fan?
Yeah. And so you said you graduated in 95. I graduated high school in 99. So I'm just like a few years behind there. And for me, it really hit for me when Mystery Science Theater moved to the Sci-Fi channel. It had been on Comedy Central. And I think in 97-ish, it moved to Sci-Fi channel. And that's when I had access to it. So I grew up in very rural Ohio. So I did not have access to cable. We literally did not have cable TV. We live so far out in the country, they wouldn't run the cable lines to our house. But in the mid 90s, we got those cool little satellite dishes, the little mini ones. And so I could finally get cable television. And that happened right around the same time that Mystery Science Theater moved to the Sci-Fi channel. So I finally had access to it. I think I had heard about it before then. I think I saw a episode when it was on Comedy Central, like in a hotel room, or my mom lived in a smaller city, and so she had cable. And so I caught it here and there, but yeah, it didn't really click for me until I started watching it on the Sci-Fi channel, started watching it regularly. And I'm not quite sure what led me to it. Like I said, I think I had known and heard about it as something that, I don't know, was funny, was cool. I don't know. It kind of fit into this, for lack of a better term, like nerd niche, you know, of people who liked funny things and also like sci-fi and things of that nature. And that was very much me. So I think I just knew of it as something that I probably would like if I watched it. And when I finally had access to it, I started watching it. And lo and behold, I did really like it. So I just watched it all the time when I was, you know, in that like late 90s era when I was in high school and had nothing better to do.
Yeah, it definitely, because it was picking these bizarre movies that you weren't going to see anywhere else. You know, these B-list sci-fi movies, and B-list might even be
in some cases probably terrible. Yeah.
So it was movies that you weren't going to see otherwise. And the other thing that just occurred to me is it's also a little bit ahead of director's cuts with voiceovers.
Right. Yeah, that's something that I didn't really connect until I was much older. At the time, it was just like, oh, this is funny. I like watching it. It's cool. That's, you know, that's why I like it. And then later, as I became more interested in film, and I still am, and I'm interested in filmmaking in the process, I also realized that there's something really interesting in this idea of having people comment on the film in real time. Even if they're doing it with snark, it still kind of engages you in the process of thinking about the film. In some ways, I think it's really illuminating to filmmaking because you're learning what doesn't work and why it doesn't work. And it's very clear what doesn't work. So it's almost like an anti-director's commentary in that way. But I feel like it's coming from the same place of interest, you know, interested in movies and talking about movies.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the characters. I do have the IMDb up to remind myself. But you've always got the main guy, and it's always a guy, right? So I guess what you've already clarified for me is that I always thought I didn't realize that they were a science experiment. I always thought they were like trapped on a failed space station, and like they just had movies to watch.
Yeah. Well, and you know, that's the nice part of the show is, you know, you don't really have to. It's all cool. But yeah, technically the story was there is a mad scientist and his great experiment was shooting people against their will, or actually shooting one person, the one guy, he said. So early, it started out with Joel, and then he escaped, and Mike came in to do that. And then when they did the reboot, it was Jonah. But yeah, there's always this one individual. And in the beginning, Joel was the one that got shot into space to participate in this experiment. And then he built robots to keep him company so that he wasn't making just jokes to himself. Like, yeah. So then his robot came out. Yeah.
So then that's where Tom Servo Crow T Robot, and Gypsy come in, that those are the three that he's built.
I should have brought it. I actually have a life-size Tom Servo that I have in another room. I should have brought that in. I didn't even think about that.
Please tell me more. Did you make it or did you buy it?
It's actually a gift for somebody who bought it from somebody else who had made it. I think like an Etsy or something, because it's been several years ago, and it was just kind of a random, you like this thing and it would be fun to buy it. So people sell those sort of thing on Etsy. Tom Servo is a lot easier to build than the other one. He's a little bit more like contained. Crow's a little bit more, has spindly arms and things like that, but it's hard. So I think it's easier to build Tom, and he's my favorite anyway. So
that is phenomenal. So is he's the like candy jar?
Yeah, it looks like a pinball machine. Sorry, not pinball, gumball machine, the other ball machine.
So how big is a life-size Tom Servo?
Yeah, I say life-size like he's a real person that I've met, you know? So I guess I don't know for sure, but it's a good 2 feet, 2.5 feet tall. I don't know this distance very well, yeah. But it's big enough that I have considered cosplaying at Comic Cons in fact I have like an outfit as like the lady version of the human person, yeah. And I've wanted to bring Tom with me, but he's so big and bulky, I'm like, I don't want to carry him around the whole time, so I haven't figured out a solution to that. I don't know if I need to get like a baby sling or something, but he's like in the show he like has a hover, he hovers around on his own power, and like that would be much more useful, but mine does not have hover capabilities, so
right. It would be like he would need a Roomba, but a Roomba that follows you, which I don't think exists.
It's difficult, yeah. So I haven't quite worked that one out yet.
That is so fun. Do you cosplay and go to Comic Cons?
No, I do go to Comic Cons a lot. I don't do a lot of the cosplay. It's some things that I like, and then I just never get around to actually doing it. My daughter actually does a lot. She's really into anime and Japanese video games and stuff like that. So she does cosplay, so but I enjoy going to Comic Cons and just kind of like, you know, like I mentioned, I'm kind of in that, I guess the boundaries are more expansive these days, you know, it's not just the small minority anymore, but whatever that group of people is that enjoys Comic Cons, I'm definitely in it.
Right. So you find Mystery Science Theater 3000 in high school when you get satellite TV and you get access to the sci-fi station. And then does it stay like a constant for you, or do you have some lulls in your fandom?
No, yeah, definitely kind of not exactly went away. I mean, I would say definitely I stayed a fan, but you know, there was a time when it was just a lot harder to get it. So once it went off the air in 99, if I'm not mistaken, 99 or 2000, so it was canceled. And so there were no more episodes. So, you know, back in those days, I mean, we didn't have as much internet all over the place, you know, that if something wasn't on the air anymore, like it was gone. And there were some DVDs being produced, but not a lot, even at that time. And I think over the years, there was really selective. So there were some DVDs floating around. There were people who made their own VHS tapes. I had made my own tapes that I no longer have, and I really regret that. But it just wasn't easy to get a hold of it after a while. Once it went off the air, it was just kind of like, well, how do you get this? And you know, now you can go on YouTube and get anything you would want. And there's streaming. There's the company that produces the DVDs has their own streaming channel that has like every episode you could possibly want. But definitely for, I would probably say for like the aughts there. While I was still a fan, I didn't really have access to it. I think I had like maybe one or two compilations. I also didn't have like a ton of money to spend on DVD sets, right. You know? So, yeah, there definitely was a time when, even though I still liked it a lot, it was more of a little bit more of a past thing, a thing that I liked when I was younger and had more access to. It's so strange that that's just how media was then, that it's very much not that now, right?
Yeah, it is. It's something that I talk to people a lot. I did a recent interview, the episode's not out yet, but with a Doctor Who fan, of what it was like to grow up watching it on PBS and how different PBS stations showed it in different ways. And then there was just this gap where there weren't tapes available. You couldn't just dial it up on your computer. This idea that you know, in 2020, if you become a fan of something or someone, it you can just do a deep dive and almost everything is available in one form or another that we don't, but we're not facing these like droughts of content.
Right. Yeah, it's completely different. And it's also very kind of isolating. You know, I didn't know other Mystery Science Theater fans when I was a teenager, when I was actually watching it. I was, you know, like I mentioned, I grew up very much out in rural Ohio, a small high school. I don't think, even though I had a couple of friends who liked some of the other nerd stuff that I liked, I don't think they were into Mystery Science Theater for some reason. It was just me, you know? So I remember being a teenager, I knew nobody else who liked it. And it was just, so that was another thing that when it went off the air and I didn't have regular access to it anymore, I also didn't have anybody around to talk to about it. So it really did kind of, for me for a while, it turned into just one of these things that like I liked when I was younger. And now it's just kind of gone. And what are you going to do? You know, I love that. That was great. I like it. But now it's completely different. It's completely turned around. Like I mentioned, there's stuff all over the internet and not just the actual media. There's like fans. I remember the first time like I connected with people online who knew what Mystery Science Theater was and had watched it too. It like blew my mind. I was like, oh, wow, I've never had this before. I've never known other people who are interested in that and everything. So it's a completely different landscape now. And then, like you mentioned, it's come back. They did a reboot. I don't think they have any of the original episodes still on Netflix, but Netflix did a reboot of it just in the past couple of years. And when they had that, they still have that running there. And then they had a bunch of the old ones like on Netflix. So it was just kind of like, this is as, you know, the opposite situation as one could possibly be in. Now you could stream these things on Netflix and there's a brand new show and there's a whole new group of people who are interested in it. And it just, it's wild. So the writing team, I think, always had at least two women that I know of. But yeah, they definitely were more visible in the most recent incarnation. Yeah.
Yeah, I did. Actually, I did notice that. I did notice that there were a number of women in the writer's room who wrote for like the whole time. So I think that is really impressive.
Yeah, definitely.
Like Bridget Jones wrote on 150 episodes. There's a Mary Jo.
Yeah, I think Bridget and Mary Jo particularly, I think. And they did show up as Mary Jo played Pearl Forrester, who was the mother of the original mad scientist, Dr. Forrester.
Okay.
And he kind of like died when the show went to the Sci-Fi Channel. There was a little bit of a cast change. And so there's a couple people who left the cast and then a couple other people from, I think from the writing team all stepped up into different roles. And so Mary Jo became like the villain there. And Bridget would pop up in some other side things. A fun thing is that and when we talk about like there is a new official Mystery Science Theater, like I said, that came out with Netflix, but some of the cast members have also gone on to do similar projects. So there's also what's called Rift Tracks, which is three of the Mystery Science Sport Theater performers, including Mike Nelson, and then two other writers and performers, Kevin Murphy and Bill Corbett. They created something called Rift Tracks, which is basically the same principle, except they don't have actual silhouettes going on. And they tend to do more, they do a lot of contemporary films, so sometimes they will release just audio tracks that you sync up to, like, if you really wanted to hear somebody make fun of, like, Lord of the Rings, you can download their commentary track and then sync it up with your own version of Lord of the Rings and listen to their joke tracks. But they also do the same thing of like taking older movies and then you can get the whole movie there. But they do their own thing with Rift Tracks, and Mary Jo and Bridget actually are kind of like their own little duo.
Okay.
And they do a lot of really great riffs themselves. And I think that it's really great to see like, yeah, two women who are doing all the riffing and probably all the riffs too. And they have a whole series of stuff that they do, just the two of them. And it's really cool.
Awesome. I've just opened up that tab. It looks really fun.
It is a lot of fun. Rift Tracks has been one of those things, definitely, I think, for a long time, because it's been around for many years. And it was before they had the reboot. So for a while, it's like, if you were into this stuff, this was your only source of like new content that was created in those molds. And they would do things like, they're not doing it right now, unfortunately, because of the pandemic, but they would do live broadcasts to actual movie theaters. So you can go to a theater and see the live broadcast of them doing it on stage. And so, you know, a little bit more of a communal event there, which is very cool.
On their guest riffers, they've had Weird Al on, Paul F. Tompkins, Fred Willard before he passed away. All right, I'm going to have to dig into this. I think it's going to, it looks like it's going to scratch my itch of, I listened to the podcast, How Did This Get Made? A lot. So this is sort of in the spirit of intentionally watching a bad movie. I like to look for for podcasts that can feel like company right now. And so this is something that would give me the feeling of watching movies with someone.
Yes. Yeah. No, Riff Tracks is definitely that. And, you know, it's interesting you bring up other podcasts like that. I actually have not listened to How Did This Get Made, although I know of it. But there's another podcast called The Flophouse that does very much the same thing that I've listened to for a number of years. And for some reason, like, I found them. And so I've just like listened to them for many years. And in fact, one of the hosts of that ended up being the head writer of the Mystery Science Theater reboot at Netflix. So it's kind of, there's like crisscrossing all over the place. But yeah, it's that same type of thing. And I think it does, at least one of the things that I really noticed in that podcast, and I think is in Riff Tracks, I think it's in Mystery Science Theater, is that even when they're making jokes or making fun of something, I think it really still comes from this deep love of movies. And that's what I think where you kind of can connect to the communal aspect of too. Because like, if you love movies, then, you know, sitting down and watching something like this or listening to something like this makes you feel like you're with other people who love movies and you're all just having like a good joking time about it. And it's great.
Yeah. Today, do you have any DVDs or do you watch it mostly online?
A little bit of both. I have some DVDs. Like I mentioned, the company that is licensed to produce the official Mystery Science Theater DVDs is called Shout Factory, I believe. And they actually have their own streaming channel. It's not super sophisticated. And I actually just added on to Amazon Prime. It's like $3 a month. And I'm pretty sure they have pretty much every Mystery Science Theater episode you could want, you can watch via that. So that's cool. They're all over YouTube. Those are like the bootleg versions, which honestly, sometimes I like that because you can get rare ones. A lot of times they're like rips from VHS copies. And so they'll have like the Sci-Fi Channel bumps or edgy commercials, which I remember from taping when I was young. So you could get, you know, a little bit of that in there. And I also, I feel very strongly, one of the reasons I mentioned things like Riff Tracks and other things is I think that a lot of the original writers and performers, from just the way things work, don't get a lot of revenue from the original Mystery Science Theater. And so if you support them in their other projects, that's really cool.
So I'm curious, do you have a couple episodes or one DVD in particular? Do you have some comfort food episodes that are you're just like, I gotta watch it again?
You know, almost all of them, not to sidestep your question, I will get more specific, but I will say that, like, just in general, Mystery Science Theater is probably my number one comfort. Everybody's probably got one, right? Like, you know, you want to put something on, you want to be entertained, but you don't want to maybe, you know, you don't want to give it your full attention right then at that moment, or you do, but you just need something really comforting. Mystery Science Theater in general is that for me. So basically, yeah, the episode serves that purpose. I like I really like, they did at least two, maybe three Ed Wood movies. And those are always fun. I think three that I really like, because that's just as classic B movie as you can get. There's The Bride of the Monster, which is the one that has Bela Lugosi, right before he died. And then there's a couple that are more of Ed Wood's like social plague films. So like one of them is about like juvenile delinquents. And one is about like the smut picture racket and the crime around that and stuff like that. So they just have this kind of great, retro sensibility, freaking out about things that maybe aren't really necessary to freak out about. So they're just a lot of fun.
So if Mystery Science Theater is your top comfort food shows, are there other series that you would put up with it, or is it it's the one?
I mean, it's definitely the one, I think, also just because of longevity, because it has been for so many years for me. There are definitely other things that I watched when I was a teenager. I was a big Star Trek fan. I like Deep Space Nine a lot, and I still watch that, but it's not the same type of I put it on all the time type thing. So I think that has a lot to do with it, where it's just something that has been such a constant, even when in those dry years that we talked about where I didn't have access to it. It still was like something I really liked, and I had that connection beforehand. So I think the consistency of it kind of helps with that comfort aspect a lot. There's definitely a lot of, I watch a lot of movies and television shows now, so there's definitely a lot that I will watch comfort wise. And there are a lot of them are like more modern kind of comedies, like Parks and Rec, The Good Place. All those things are nice and wonderful and heartwarming, and they make me feel good.
Yeah.
But there's something about Mystery Science Theater, I think also because there's so much of it. Like there were 10 seasons they produced, and they're all like movie length episodes, right? It's not like a half hour episode. So I think that it just kind of does make it my ultimate.
Yeah, it is remarkable that they were on the air for 11 years before the cancellation in 99, right? So like at its heart, it is like a local access sci-fi comedy show.
Yeah, it is. And there's something about that I really like too. I didn't grow up in the age of having like the individual host necessarily. That was a little bit before my time, but I'm from Northeastern Ohio, and there was still a very legendary, like the horror host Goulardi, was back in the 60s. And that was something that like I was raised up with, this idea of like, this is the thing that people had. They had these hosts that talked about like bad horror movies and made jokes. And that was what Goulardi did. And Mystery Science Theater is essentially like updating that whole thing. And so it feels like, I think that's part of the comfort too, where it like really ties back to these things that I know that went back even farther than me in a way too. It's also like, I think Mystery Science Theater is very Midwestern. And I'm a lifelong Midwesterner. And I feel like there's something about not only is it literally, it was filmed in Minneapolis by people who all lived in Minneapolis at the time. And, or as they famously make fun of Mike consistently, he was from Wisconsin. So they make fun of him all the time for that. But there is this sort of kind of like self-effacing, down to earth type of dry Midwestern humor that runs through it that I really like too. And so, it's been this way. It's like this small little out of the way public access television show, puppet show kind of thing. And it just, I think that's part of the comfort about it too. It's just like, oh, this is just something a bunch of people got together and did and had fun with.
Yeah, and I think that Midwestern sense of humor is also why it is not—it's not a mean show. It's not a snarky show. It is ultimately a good humored and kind. And because it was always on either local access or basic cable, it's not. It wasn't rated R, even if the movie might have been.
Right. And, every once in a while, some of the jokes were a little like, there are definitely jokes that I didn't understand when I was younger that I grew up and be like, I didn't even know what they were pointing to. But there's not a lot of that. It is. It's a very just kind of, yeah, it's very nice. And I mean that in the best possible way, not in any sort of a hidden meaning way. It is just very nice. And like I said, I think that also, I said it before, but one of the things I really like about it is I think it comes out of loving movies. I think it comes out of that love. It doesn't come from a place of being superior and looking down on something and just trying to rip it apart because you think that it's fun to be mean. I really think it comes from that. And I think a lot of people misunderstand a lot of this type of stuff when you talk about like, oh, it's making fun of bad movies. And I don't know, if somebody wants to rip things apart, then I guess they can spend their time the way they want to.
Right.
But that's not what I'm interested in. And that's not what I feel like Mystery Science Theater has ever done. And I think it really still comes out of like, oh, we love movies. We love them so much that we like to joke and laugh about them. And sometimes you don't see how they fall short of maybe our expectations or our hopes, but it still comes out of all of that love. And that's what makes it, I think, a much more pleasant experience than it might otherwise be.
Yeah. So I'm curious, did you either help with the Kickstarter? Have you ever been to a live show? What have some of your modern interactions with it been?
Yeah, definitely. So they did have, I think it's been 2 or 3 years ago now. This was before the reboot. I think it was before the reboot on Netflix was even announced. They did get like the whole cast back together for a live show in Minneapolis. And it just happened to be a summertime when my daughter was visiting family. And so I drove from Chicago to Minneapolis and I went to the live show and it was a lot of fun. It was the first time the entire original cast had been together and they did, you know, they ripped like shorts live basically. And so that was fun. And I think that was kind of the beginning of getting like a reboot together. And as you mentioned, yeah, there was Kickstarter for that. I did contribute to the Kickstarter. They also, when they were done with the new reboot season, they went around to several theaters around the country and premiered the first episode in the theaters. And it just so happened that they came to a theater that I used to live very close to, the Music Box Theater in Chicago, which is one of my favorite places in the world. I talk about it all the time.
Yes.
Premiered the first episode of the Mystery Science Theater reboot there. So I went to go see that, and that was great because a lot of the cast showed up. In fact, there were a couple of the older cast that I had. There's one in particular. I'll give a shout out to Mr. Bill Corbett, who was one of the original writers. I actually got connected with him on Twitter, and he just a really funny, kind guy.
I love it.
And I'm saying this not to be like, oh, look at this. I'm saying this because he's really nice, and I'd like to talk about that. At that, the reboot premiere in the theater, I saw him kind of in the back and I just really quickly, I'm like, hey, I just wanted to say hi. I think we've talked a little bit on Twitter. Nice to meet you and everything. And he recognized me from Twitter and sat and talked to me for a while, introduced me to his wife and just like was wonderful. And it was such a wonderful experience.
The internet has really reshaped. One, it allows fans to find each other. So if you think you're the only person who likes someone or likes something, then you're just not using the internet.
Right. Yeah. It's almost impossible to get away from it.
Yeah. Nothing is so niche that you can't find extra people. Other people to be in a fandom with. And I think that's really exciting.
I think so too. And it's, you know, definitely, honestly, when you're talking about fandoms online, you know, we've seen evidence of toxicity that starts in some places, but I still think overall, it's way better to be able to connect with other people who love the things you do than not.
Yeah.
I grew up really isolated and not knowing very few people were into the things that I liked. And it's not just like being able to share things with other people. It like really, when you don't have communities like that, it really leads you to doubt your own interests and your own kind of capabilities of like whether, you know, you can maybe do something similar. Maybe you can tell stories or something like that. And I definitely had a lot of that. And, you know, now that I'm all grown up and I know the larger world out there, you know, I look back and realize there are so many things that I didn't know then about what I could do and that the things that I was interested in were valuable and,
right.
You know, were valuable to other people and brought joy to, could bring joy to people. And I didn't know that back then. And it would have changed a lot for me if I knew that. And I think that's a big thing that communities can do. When you find other people, it just kind of helps, you know, I guess the word I'm thinking of is legitimize, but you know, sometimes you need that extra stamp of approval to help you believe in it or give you permission to say, it's okay, you can like this and this is a good thing and maybe it will be helpful to people, that sort of thing. And I think that the internet really does help that. It helps bring people together and helps them like explore their interests and believe in what they like.
Yeah, I think it makes a huge difference. And I also think I'm so hopeful that we have buried the ironic like.
Oh, yes. I agree with you 100%. Yeah.
I am here for people legitimately and fully loving stuff and being excited to talk about whatever that thing is and not with an ironic detachment. Like, why did we let that become a thing?
Yeah, it really was, though. And I think from, you know, we talked about when we graduated high school, I think that we were really not so much like in the middle of it. At least I feel like I came on the tail end of that. But that was still something I felt like I definitely learned that, like, yeah, it's not cool to be super into things, to be enthusiastic.
Right.
You're supposed to, yeah, you, like you said, detached. And then I think that that actually kind of turned into cynicism. It got even worse than detachment, you know? I think it went full into cynicism. And at some point, I think I performed that for a while. And then at some point, I'm like, I don't want to do this anymore. I think maybe you just get old enough where you feel like you don't care. It doesn't matter anymore. But I don't, like I mentioned, I've got a daughter who's a teenager, and I don't think they have that same thing. I mean, you know, teenagers, but
right.
I don't think they have that same type of expectation where they're not allowed to be excited about things. I think it's the opposite. And I think it has a lot to do with the internet, and you can find all these, like, my daughter is into things that I wouldn't have access to because I didn't have the internet when I was her age.
Right.
You know, I didn't have anime to watch, you know, I didn't go to comic cons and have cosplay and things like that. And she has found the things that she loves, and she's found people who are into the things that she loves, and they can share it and they can make things from it. And it's never, I hope it's never occurred to her to think that, like, that's weird or wrong. Cause there's already a community that she knows that does that. And I think that is an amazing thing. And so, yeah, I hope that kind of ironic cynicism is dead as
yeah.
well.
Yeah. And my hope is that as we come out of COVID and this, I'm not going to assume your politics, but this, hopefully we get out of this fascist state that we're crawling into.
Yes.
Okay. I thought so. I think that when we get to the other side of this moment in time, people are right. Like KonMari, the whole phenomenon of, like, does it spark joy? And it should it be in your house if it doesn't spark joy? Like, a lot of people were really snarky about that. But I think now, after this incredibly dark and dangerous period we're living through, I think it will be, right? Like, did the Jazz Age come after the Depression, or was it before?
It was before, but it came after World War One, which was, you know, kind of a bummer.
Yeah. And as we, I don't think I could have named the influence of 1918 before all of this, but I hope we see just a massive full-hearted embracing of joy and the things that we love and art. I can't wait to get back to live comedy and live anything.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. And I think that makes a lot of sense. I think there's reason to hope for that. And I think that, you know, going through these times, it makes you think a little bit more purposefully about what you're doing in your life. And also kind of more introspectively, maybe, and for many of us, because we have no other option, we can't go out and do things. So we might as well look inward a little bit more.
Tell me a little bit about the podcast you started. Is this a COVID project, or is it a pre-COVID project?
It is a COVID project. Having said all those things about, like, joy and laughter, this podcast is a little bit different. I mean, it's totally fun. But the subject matter is me and my friend Jesse, who are interested in psychological horror movies.
Jesse.
Yes. I was right. I was like, I think that's how I know Jasmine, how I found you. But yeah. So Jesse and I have been doing this podcast.
Yes.
And we kind of got connected because we like film. This is like the flip side of the like sci-fi horror films in Mystery Science Theater. So this is like the other end of the spectrum, which I also like. And she and I were interested in that. So yeah, we started just doing kind of a conversational podcast, talking about our favorite psychological horror films, like the slow burn type films, which are kind of having a moment right now.
Yeah.
So we felt that, like, we're not just covering contemporary ones, but like trying to make sure we cover older ones too. But it's definitely having a moment right now. So we figured it was a good time to talk about it. So
before I ask this question, what is the name of the podcast?
Yes, I just realized at the end of all that I didn't say it. So it's called Quiet Little Horrors.
Quiet Little Horrors. That was a slow burn psychological thriller. Is that like Us or Get Out, or is that... I'm not a horror film person. No, I'm a scaredy cat, but I have seen both of those. I felt like they seemed important, but I don't know why I went. They were terrifying.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, they're terrifying. They're good. It's definitely in that realm. And that's honestly part of the reason we're kind of doing the podcast, is almost to define what we're interested in and the act of doing it. Mm-hmm. It's definitely a loose topic. So we're kind of like trying to focus things that are not necessarily like really in your face, not like slashers or things like that, which there's nothing wrong with those. It's just like, we're trying to kind of stake out territory. It's a little bit different. Like our first episode was on The Witch, which came out recently.
Okay.
And I think that's probably like one of the things that kicked off this new type of like art house, quiet horror. Definitely. I feel like Get Out and Us are in that realm. I think it's all about like trying to find these stories that are in the margins, mm-hmm. Which is something else that we've been interested in. And we haven't quite pulled out. We've only got a couple episodes out. We'll get there. But, you know, we are interested in the stories that a lot of these stories are revolving around marginalized characters or people from different perspectives. And we're really interested in that, too, because that seems to be why it's having such a moment now, is that's an opportunity to tell these stories that maybe haven't been told before.
Well, it's exciting. I know that Jesse's loving it. So
it's been a lot of fun, honestly. I think it just happened to be the right time, the right intersection of people who want to talk about a thing. And so, it's been a lot of fun. Yeah.
So cool. Well, Jen, this has been super fun. And I'm happy to have realized towards the end how we are actually, our social circles don't skirt by each other, but they firmly overlap with Jesse. And this has been so fun. So go ahead and share the name of the podcast one more time, where people can find and follow you for the times when you are on Twitter.
Okay, so my podcast is called Quiet Little Horrors, and we have a website. It's quietlittlehorrors.com. You can also find it in all the podcast places where you find things. We're everywhere. And then for me personally, I also have a website at jenmyers.net. It's jenmyers.net. And I do a lot of writing there. I have a weekly newsletter, so there's links there for that. And then I am on Twitter more than I probably should be, but I'm over at Twitter at anti-heroin. I handle there.
And you keep a Soderbergh media diary on your website.
I do. I've kept a media log of every TV series I watch, every movie I watch, every book I read. And I've been doing that for 4 years. So yeah, that's a lot of fun. I actually like doing that.
It's very cool. I have considered it, but then I think I would have to admit how often I just replay the same podcast episodes. And I don't know if I want to come to terms with how much I just am like subsisting on podcasts as company right now.
I totally get that. I will admit, once I've seen like certain, like maybe television shows, my daughter and I watch a lot of TV shows together. So like I don't put on my list the third time we watched The Office.
Right.
Like, that feels a little unnecessary.
Yeah.
the sixth time we watched What We Do in the Shadows, which we're obsessed with. Yeah, you have to be a person who likes like recording things and making lists, which I am.
Yeah.
And for the record, if anybody is interested, I actually on GitHub have a HTML template, the one that I use on my website. So if anybody wants to do a media log on their own websites, I have a free template that I use that has like all the structure in place and the key for the different kinds of media. So that's linked for my website too. I think it's actually in my projects page. There's a link to my media template. So yeah.
Fantastic. Well, Jen, this has been a blast.
This has been really fun. Thank you so much.
I'm gonna try listening to the podcast, and if it's too scary to even listen about horror movies, then I will just tell Jesse I love her and she knows I mean well.
Yeah, that's perfectly valid.
Great. Well, have a wonderful afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Finding Favorites with Leah Jones. Please make sure to subscribe and drop us a 5-star review on iTunes. Now, go out and enjoy your favorite things.